So yeah, I've been trying to write a little Go every day.
So sowing the Go garden?
Trying to. Yeah, it's very different. It's just very much more DIY stuff. So I don't know if this is part of the show or if you want to be part of the show.
It is now. Keep talking.
Well, so for example, like I mentioned, I'm trying to write just a little Go every day, and I'm working on the code test project a little bit and trying to do a couple other small projects with it. And one thing that I've never really had to roll my own of before ever is like a migration setup, like how I'm going to manage migrations and how I'm going to store them in the database, where I'm going to keep the migrations, how they're going to be run. How do you handle, like, okay, what if you have to do a database migration plus, you know, some data migrations, you know, Rails and Phoenix and, well, not Phoenix, Ecto and, Laravel sort of all have that just, it just comes with it, right? So it's never something I had to think about before. So I'm finding that more and more as I jump into Go. Yeah, there are some frameworks out there like Buffalo and different things like that. But more and more, I'm finding that I just have to just put it together. And I want to say it's more akin to Node, or I think I said that in the last episode. But, you know, even Node, I feel like there's more clear cut. Like, here's like a good system that you would use. Whereas, with Go, I'm not saying they're bad at all. I'm just saying that there's like a few options and they're okay. But most of the open source things I've looked at, like Mattermost or Gogs or GitT, for example, they sort of all just sort of do their own thing.
I think before Rails, no one was even doing migration stuff. I mean, I never certainly heard of it before I was doing Rails stuff. Granted, I was still pretty green at that point. But I don't think that migrations were really a thing that were commonly used. I mean, certainly we didn't have giant web frameworks like that people were working on, so maybe it was kind of a solution to a new problem. I know when I was doing web development back at my small shop and a summer job doing Cold Fusion stuff, we just had the database, dev databases that we just kind of passed around, and you know, we had like a local, it was a Microsoft SQL Server. We would just have the database there, and we'd add in roof tables and stuff. And then I don't remember how we ended up getting that stuff to production. I think we would just either do it by hand, you know, just create the tables and stuff before we to publish the new code, or maybe it was scripted somehow. But certainly there was no record of the changes and the history and the ability to, you know, roll back or anything like that. It was just kind of fly by the seat of your pants, edit stuff in production. And you know what? Honestly, it was fine. Like, you got backups of everything. Obviously, it doesn't scale, but like, there was a life before migrations.
Well, probably more downtime too, right? Like, when you had to do those migrations, I remember getting emails all from different various apps saying like, oh, tomorrow night we're going to have 2 hours of downtime or whatever while we make some changes to our system. And I always understood that to be like, oh, you're probably doing something to the database, which that's why, in my mind, that's the only reason why you would require downtime, because that's the source of truth for everything in most cases.
Yeah, that's fair. That's probably true. It's really interesting to me. I'm really curious, as you learn more about Go and report back to us and our listeners, how much there's this trade-off of raw performance that Go provides versus this kind of do-it-yourself mentality, and you're not quite getting the convenience that you would have gotten with other frameworks. I guess I'm curious to find out if it feels like it's worth it, if it feels like going your own road and solving these problems one at a time, if that becomes old and tired, or does it really offer you the flexibility that you really need?
So I guess it depends on what your goals are, what you're trying to accomplish, and how proficient you are. So I could see, you know, somebody like Greg, you know, he's the one that got me into Go in the first place around the first of the year. I think, I don't remember how many episodes ago that would have been, but we're talking about, he had started rebuilding his blog and he was using Go. And so we were talking about it, and that inspired me to give it a try, you know. And for someone like him, he's been using it for 6 years or something like that now, and he's so proficient that for him, it's not even a second thought. It's like, okay, well, I have to do this, this, and this. And then he just sort of sets out doing them. I guess for me, that's similar to with Phoenix and Elixir, right? While Phoenix and Elixir get me a little bit farther down the road out the gate, you still have to do some of the yarn work and make some of your own decisions, whether it's like an authorization layer or whatever, as compared to Rails Rails or Laravel, where especially Laravel, where that ships, like, there's like a few different solutions you can use out of the box. You know, they have one specifically for authentication API tokens. They have one specifically for cookie sessions and server-side rendered apps. So, you know, Phoenix is certainly somewhere in the middle. But I think it's for someone that's like proficient, knows what they're doing, and sort of knows where they want to go. No pun intended. You know, I think it's probably fine in their eyes. And in fact, like I said, in most of my scouring or lurking around on the net, the sentiment seems to be, I know what I want. I know how I want to get there. So I would rather not have it done for me, because in their minds, having it done for them, it's not how they want it exactly. And so they're going to spend 6 months fighting. They're going to spend more time in 6 months fighting a framework rather than spending a little bit extra time now having things exactly how they want it. But like I said, it depends on your goals. And so in my goals, where I'm at, especially with Go, you know, I'm not proficient in it. According to Pluralsight, I'm adequate. I can't remember what the term was.
Adequate.
Middle of the road is what I scored on the test, which I'll take that. I haven't, you know, written that much Go. But with my goals, you know, it's more so like I'm trying to build something with Go. And I went in, you know, supposedly with some app experience, and then, you know, realizing, oh, I have to do all this other stuff. For me, it was sort of a shell shock, but also I think it was a shell shock because it was unexpected, I guess, having to build that stuff. I think, yeah, it depends on what the goals are. And I think generally when people are using Go, their goals aren't to throw up a SaaS or something, which seems like it would be a better fit for something like Rails or Laravel or even Phoenix. You know, Go is used for very many more things than just specifically web apps. So I think, you know, the ecosystem, the community is growing. You know, like we're seeing more frameworks. Like there's a handful now. I mean, Buffalo is probably the most full-featured one. There's another interesting one I was looking at the other day called Echo. Echo seems pretty cool. There's Iris, there's Chin, there's handfuls of them, you know? So it's growing. It's just that early on, I think that the emphasis wasn't, oh, we're going to use Go to build web apps. It was more of a tooling language. I mean, that's why you see a lot of things like Docker, Kubernetes, even like GitHub's Actions stuff. I'm pretty sure that's all powered by Go, because if you look at job listings, they're hiring for Ruby and Go developers. So I think there's a sort of section of the community that is building tools and morphing things more towards general purpose web applications. But I really don't think that was the focus or has been the focus for people building stuff with Go.
Now that you know the language a little more and you have a view of the landscape, is there anything particular about the language itself that makes it well suited to being web application? Is it just pure performance, or is there some other advantage there? I mean, for example, when we talk about Elixir and Phoenix, you get OTP and very good concurrency and, you know, all the other buzzwords that go along with Elixir and Erlang and the Beam. Are there those kind of things for Go that particularly make it good for web apps?
Well, a lot of people talk about Go routines. So Go also is touted as having a good concurrency model through Go routines and channels. And I don't know enough about them, or I know a bit about them, but I can't speak intelligently, or I can't speak with authority on those subjects. But Go does have a pretty good concurrency model in Go routines, and so that's that's a good reason why people have been choosing it more and more. And if you look at a lot of the web frameworks that are out there, they talk about how that works. So, I mean, like with Phoenix, right, you come in and you get a little bitty process and you're sort of isolated. With most of the Go web frameworks, as far as I can tell, each one sort of like spins up a little Go routine. And so you get that similar concurrency model out of the gate. And I guess I want to use similarly, that word similarly there, like very loosely. Yeah. I mean, there is the concurrency model. And in fact, that's why Greg told me that he reached out for Go in the first place. It was way back in the day, and Go seemed to have a good concurrency model. So that's what brought him around to it, actually.
And plus you have type safety there, which is obviously, mm-hmm. you know, good for finding bugs before they happen. And also, I think the deployment story has got to be way easier too, right? Because when you compile these applications, you pretty much just end up with a single binary file.
Yep. And you don't have any external dependencies. So one thing that's kind of fun, and I can talk, I guess I can segue into that in a second, but with talking about, you know, building executables essentially with, so when I first did the code test, my migration story was that the migrations were stored. I think we talked about this. The migrations were in SQL files. And there were special tags that you used to denote the up and down operations to be run, right? And then you basically had to, in Go, you can have a tools.go file. And what happens is you can actually say like, okay, when I'm deploying this, I need this specific binary executable to be available wherever I'm going to be working on this thing, even if it's not being used in my direct application, because if a dependency is not being used, it's going to get cleaned out. So you can use a tools.go file to sort of specify those things. And so I had a tools.go file specifying, hey, I need this, I'm using a library called Goose. I need this Goose executable in here so that way I can like SSH into my production server and run my migrations. Okay. And what I did next was, in this latest refactors, I switched from using SQL files for migrations to using Go files for migrations. So that way I can actually, if I needed to do data changes as well as database migrations, I could do those in Go, right? Similar to with Ecto, you have your migrations and you write them in a DSL with Elixir, right? And what's cool is that with Goose, you basically make your own main.go file for it, and then you build it into an executable, and then you just put that in, like you just leave that in your repository. And so wherever you ship your stuff, you suddenly have your own custom built migrate executable that you can use to run against your database. And you don't have to, when you run the migrate command, you don't have to pass in like database configs, where the migration folder lives and all that stuff.
That's interesting. So
yeah.
So instead of running sort of in Rails land, you've got rake tasks. Your tasks are actually individual executables.
Yes. Yeah. And there are other libraries for task specific things, but with Go, it's funny. It feels very much like a tooling language because yeah, you're like, okay, I need this executable and I want it to be tailored to my app. Well, you literally just make a main.go file. And so I'm using a command pattern. So the directory layout would be like cmd/migrate/main.go. And so when you run go build, you would run go build cmd/migrate, and that would actually build a migrate executable.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So you literally will just make the tools that you need, which is pragmatic. I don't know, straightforward. Like, you know, there's no...
That's what every woodworker and every machinist does.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So that's the vibe, you know. It's like, oh, you need this thing. Well, here's, you build it. And again, I'm coming from more, we built this thing for you. You just use it how it is. And if there's caveats, you accept those. That's just how it is. And with Go, it's like, okay, well, you choose how you want it to be and you build it to be that way.
Over long term, it's got to affect your decision-making process. Sort of, you imagine a spectrum. On the left side, it's, making silicon transistors, and on the right side it's like I'm writing COBOL or something, and then somewhere in between is like Go, where you're sort of paving your own road, but at the same time you get all the benefits of a nice strongly typed compiled language. And
well, so I mean, we can talk more about that. So like you asked like what would draw people to it, I suppose. So we just talked about how you know, the deploy story is really straightforward. I mean, you build an executable, you throw it on a server and you run it. Or you build a tool, you throw it on someone else's computer, they run it. You know, it's, you don't have to be like, okay, now you have to go over here and install this thing and then you have to do that. It's like, here's the thing that you run, which is nice.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I use Cloud 66 for managing all my servers, and they're binary. It's CX, whatever. CX it's just a Go thing, and you just download it and just run it. You just put it in your in your local, you know, user folder under bin or something, and you put it in your path and away you go.
Yeah. So deployment story is good. Another thing, I guess, is the ecosystem is big, and maybe this is only because I'm coming from Elixir where the ecosystem is smaller, but there's like a package for everything. You already mentioned that it's a strongly typed language. So the tooling is like really good. You know, it has, I was like, oh, this is awesome. Elixir has a formatter now. Go has the formatter, it has linters, it has all that stuff built into it. Tooling's great. It's fast. Consumes, well, I guess if you do things right, it consumes very little memory. That's one of the big selling points. So, you know, highly concurrent, also, you know, using very small amounts of memory. So that's, you know, those are probably two big selling points for web usage specifically. I think also the fact that, you know, it's not really an object-oriented language. It's certainly not functional, right? Like the other day I was like, okay, how do I filter something? And I'm looking around like, is there a filter method anywhere? And then of course people are like, just use a for loop. So it's very imperative, right? Very, very imperative, very not declarative, which I'm used to Elixir being declarative. But to its benefit, like the standard library or like the number of keywords, it's like a small language. It has not that many features, very small. So that means that I think like the saying is that, you know, you can learn Go inside of a couple of days, but it takes a long time to master it. And on the other side of that mastery portion, I think, is because, again, it's not really an object-oriented language, but you still have interfaces, but they're composable. So instead of like, say, Java, where everything has to like explicitly say like, okay, this is what I am and this is what I implement specifically, with Go, it's sort of all implicit. So you make an interface, and then say like you have an interface called identifiable, and that interface says that there needs to be a function that returns a string, a function ID that returns a string. Okay, any struct type can just implement that if you attach a function ID that returns a string to that struct.
You don't even need to explicitly say it's the identifiable.
No,
it's implementing the identifier thing or whatever. You just got to have that function signature somewhere.
Yes. Yep. So the mantra of Go is the smaller the interface, the better it is, the more reusable it is, right? So the whole idea...
It's almost like strongly typed duck typing in Ruby. I mean, if you squint at it.
Right. Yeah. 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 And so the whole mantra is, again, the smaller the interface, the better, because it makes it more reusable. And so the whole thing is that you sort of compose these interfaces together, as opposed to make these giant interfaces that get thrown around all over the place. You have these tiny little snapshots of functionality that you can just bolt on wherever you need them, which is very, like, I'm not used to thinking in that manner. You know, like the farthest I got into Elixir's stuff with, you know, with behaviors obviously are powerful, but this is just different, you know? So it's been sort of a mind warp for me to wrap my head around, but I'm learning to really appreciate it. It's like, okay, well, I might need to conform to this interface over here. So I'm just going to throw a function onto this type and we're good to go.
When you came to Design Collective and you inherited the Rails app, did you know Rails at that point, or were you kind of forced to pick up Ruby and Rails?
Intermediate. You know, I wasn't a Rails expert. I could ship an MVP.
Okay. So when you came to DK, you were forced, I'm using air quotes here, forced into doing Ruby on Rails.
Mm-hmm.
As that went on, you actually made the choice to completely change up how everything is done. You brought Vue in, you brought Nuxt in, you brought in Elixir and Phoenix, mm-hmm. and GraphQL. You brought in all these new technologies that you, as CTO, decided on and vetted and built into the system and sort of learned them out of your own necessity.
Right.
Whereas here you don't have a choice. Like, it doesn't matter if you like Go. You're doing it now. Right. Will be, hopefully. Knock on wood over here.
Yeah.
So that also kind of, I think, changes your mindset about it a little bit. Yeah, I don't want to say you're biased or anything, but
sure.
You know, you do have to learn it, and you know, it's a bonus if you're enjoying doing it. Obviously the team you're gonna be working for, you respect, and they're very smart, and they chose it for a good reason, and you're going to gel well with them, so obviously you're going to like it too. But you know what I'm trying to say? Like, you're it's just a different experience for you, I think.
Yeah, it is different. I mean, you know, first strong type language, first sort of lower level language, I suppose, experience with pointers and stuff. And even then, Go's pointers aren't like C's pointers by any means. They're sort of pointers with training wheels on them. So they do help you out there, which is nice, but you still have pointers. And one thing that's been really interesting to me about Go is one of the creators, Rob Pike, has like a ton of talks online, and he has all these interesting sayings that are like simple, simple. It's funny because he, like, you know, Go is simple up front. It's a small language, but it takes a long time to really master it. And he, like, everything this guy does sort of exudes that. Like, he'll put a saying out there and you'll think about it and you're like, okay, well, that's pretty simple, but it just, like, unfolds. It's like an onion, right? There's layers and layers and layers to it. I thought that was really interesting. So,
like a mantra?
Yeah, a mantra. So I was watching a little bit of a YouTube video today. I don't remember the title of it, but it was a talk from Rob. And he was talking about how, you know, Go the language was named after Go the game. And I don't know a whole lot about the Go.
Hold on, back up. See, I always assumed that it had something to do with the name Google because it came out of Google. And so I assumed it was like a shortened version of Google. Guess not.
Maybe not. I mean, he talks about Go a lot in this talk. He was talking about Go. I've never really heard him say that it's like coming from Google or the name is short for Google or anything. But he specifically, you know,
correct me if I'm wrong. It is a Google technology, right?
I don't know exactly what the official, like, how you would say that officially. I know at the bottom it's sponsored by Google. I don't know if, like, these people work for Google or if Google's just, like, paying for it.
Okay.
You know. So,
sorry to interrupt.
No, that's fine. I should probably look that up anyway. But in the talk, he was talking about how there's like an illustrated guide to Go the game patterns that was printed decades ago. I think it was a Japanese book. And so it has a little picture of like a pattern. So if people aren't aware, Go is, I don't know many of the rules, but it's like you have a square board with squares on it, and then you have white pieces and black pieces. And I think the goal is to turn all of the opposite color to your color by different moves and strategies, right? So it's similar to chess. But what Rob said was that in chess, they're very much defined rules. And so with chess, you sort of just memorize this person does that, and then I respond this way, they respond this way, and then I respond that way. Sort of black and white, there's paths that you memorize. With Go, it's very much more organic and very much more creative, I suppose, is how he describes it. And so with this book, Illustrated Go, had like a little picture, and it was sort of like a shape that you could sort of play off of, I guess, like we just described with chess. And there was a little, there was like a little blurb of text. Like, so one of them was the comb is always alive. I guess that meant like with this specific shape, if you're defending yourself, no matter if they take one of the pieces, you can always flip it back to that shape of the comb. So it's always like you're able to defend yourself that way. And so it's funny because like I'm hearing him describe the game of Go and describe like thinking about this. And then I'm remembering he just said Go is easy to learn, but difficult to master. And I was like, this is just like the game. They like made this programming language to like mirror this very complicated game called Go, which I don't know. I thought the parallels are really interesting, but there's a lot of like the philosophies of Go or the mantras of Go or whatever you want to call it, very philosophical, like feeling posts where it's sort of a, you know, on the surface, a very simple statement, but it's just like goes really deep the more you think about it.
The way you described the Go patterns reminded me of the Game of Life.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I know James Conway, I think his name is. I think he just passed away this week, past week or two, the creator of that. But it's a similar sort of thing where very, very, very simple rule set, similar to Go, again, tiles, where one is either on or off, and based off of the rules, each iteration of the game, you know, or the game of life, changes the pattern, and you can, from this really simple set of, I don't know, less than 4, 5, 6 rules, something, you can derive all these really, really complicated shapes and patterns and things that replicate and animations and all these crazy, crazy cool things.
Right, yeah, it's a different way of thinking for me for sure. And I think honestly, like any frustration that I get with Go language isn't the language; it's having to sort of learn about the ecosystem and conform to certain patterns to make a library or similar work. Right, I think that's where any frustrations I have come from. But the language itself is like pretty, you know, once you get past pointers, once you get past a few other basic things, it's really simple to work with. Which I can really appreciate. So really, like, all I did was went to the standard library packages, clicked on a few of them that I thought were important, and just read through them. So that way I could sort of if I have to do a task, I can sort of like vaguely remember, oh, I think there's a function over here for that. Even if I don't remember what it's called, it sort of jogs my memory to go back to that. That's something I picked up from Paul, actually, when he was coming into DK and he was going to start writing Elixir. Before he started, he read through the entire Elixir standard library and Ecto documentations. Just not in depth, didn't have everything memorized. But when we were talking, he's like, oh, I think I remember something in the docs about this. Let me see if I can go find it. And I think, like, if you can get to that point when you're learning something, that's a huge step forward, because that sort of solves the I don't even know where to start looking problem that people run into. And that's sort of like a combo breaker, like a showstopper for a lot of people, me included.
Yeah, I think obviously that's dependent on having good documentation to begin with, which thank God we have that. I have a friend who's been trying to pick up C Sharp. I kind of pushed him that direction and sort of learning it through Unity, because he's a big gamer and game development's always been interesting to him. So I was like, hey, Unity has these free tutorials for a couple months because of the whole coronavirus thing. And he's been going through videos and stuff and doing online. Anyway, it's great. But he's telling me how he's going through the courses, and at the end there's, you know, you have to like do a little project, and then maybe there's some stretch goals and stuff. And he's like, yeah, but they mentioned this. I don't really understand that. And I'm like, well, just go to the docs, and here's the link to the documentation. Just read the documentation. It's all there. And I forget that. I don't know if it's just you don't maybe think about doing that, or yeah, it's just so valuable to me. I enjoy doing the same thing, is just sitting down and have a cup of coffee and just have some docs try to put me back to sleep, you know?
Yeah.
It's such a good resource, and it's so easy to overlook if you're just so used to looking at blog posts and tutorials and videos and talks and stuff.
I think that stuff only gets you so far, honestly. Yeah, there's really no substitute for, again, I guess, a theme of the show going back years now is like really like having to learn your tools. And so that's why I'm trying to just write some Go every day, is to become more familiar, to like actually be able to learn the tools, so that way I can stop focusing on that and actually focus on, okay, how do I apply patterns with Go? Not so much, I guess, like once you can stop thinking, again, it's like music, right? Like once you can stop like thinking about rudimentary shapes and stuff like that, once you can start to kind of just move your hand by itself, that allows you to go to the next level in musical composition. I think with programming, it's sort of the same. Once you can get past the rudimentary things, the syntax, the gotchas, the idioms of the language, it allows you to think about, okay, well, how can I apply this other pattern I know from Elixir over here? Or how can I do this over here? Or what have you? In my case, it's, okay, how do I build a migration system? I've never done this before. And I'm thankful for it. You know, I think up front it was a little stressful because of a code test. I'm like, oh, I have like a deadline for this thing. But now it's like, okay, I'm grateful that I've had this experience to think about how to build a migration system. You know, are timestamps good enough, or should like static versions, or like should you use those? You know, so I've seen some people say like only use timestamps for dev, and then once you go to production, actually switch those migration timestamped files to like specific version files. And there's just a lot of like context and things that I didn't have to think about before that now I've thought about and have opinions about. So it's definitely helped me grow as especially a backend developer. So I appreciate that from it.
Going back to the woodworking analogy, it sounds like writing Go is sort of like you're an artisanal woodworker. You're making these finely crafted antiques using just a hand plane and some sandpaper and some chisels, right? No hardware, just wood and some glue, and you're just making these really, really exquisite pieces of art. And then on the other hand, you've got the contractor with the tool belt building a house with the 2x4s and studs with a balloon frame and joists, yeah. And like just, you know, in a couple of days putting up the frame of a house. And no, both of those people could get there in different levels of quality and time and effort. I don't know, it's just this whole different set of trade-offs, man. And there's pragmatism on both sides of it, but the focus is so totally different.
Right. And again, going back to, especially in a business sense, what does your business need at that moment? It's like, I'm not proficient enough with Elixir, or not Elixir, but Go. So I wouldn't pick that. In fact, especially most, I feel like most SaaS applications could probably just be just spin up Laravel or spin up Rails or Phoenix too. You know, Phoenix is really good. I guess it just depends on how much time you want to spend on making those smaller decisions. And obviously small, I don't mean smaller decisions as in like your authentication layer isn't important, because it is important. It's just that with something like Laravel, there's just been so many people spending so many number of hours putting this thing together that you can just use, and it'll probably be okay for you until it's not okay. And at the point where it's not okay, hopefully you've got some money and some people where you can make it okay, right? I guess that's a trade-off you're making in that case.
Yeah, here's the thing about Phoenix and Elixir. We've beaten this to death on the show, obviously.
Yeah.
When I switched the real-time part of Remote Ham Radio, all the WebSockets, PubSub, all that stuff over to Phoenix, here's the thing. I've got two instances on Amazon. They're T2 mediums, I think, which is just a moderately sized, pretty inexpensive instance, maybe like $20 a month per each one. I have metrics wired up through telemetry over to CloudWatch, and then I've got a nice Grafana dashboard. Every message that gets pushed through the system, but it gets broadcast out to a client, I have that event tracked in telemetry. And then I've got this hourly graph that shows me how many messages were pushed out to users. And I mean, it's regularly in the millions. I mean, during the contest a couple weeks ago when I was telling you about that, it was 6 million messages per hour.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this web was like 2% CPU, 3% CPU, you know, load balance between the two servers. I'm like, I have so much headroom. it's so performant for this application that money is no object. It'll scale infinitely horizontally because of the beam and everything, and the technology allows me to do that. Man, anything that I myself build, this is just going to get me so far. This gets me like to the moon. And if I need to go to Mars, well, okay, maybe I'll invest in something more dedicated and more performant. But man, I'm just so happy with the way everything's are right now.
Well, I guess like if you have to get to Mars with it, you wouldn't necessarily rebuild the whole spaceship. You would make specific rockets that would propel you faster, right? You would probably augment what you have with the different pieces that are, or you would swap out the pieces that are like lacking, that are dragging you down the most, with pieces that are more tailored for that, right?
Yeah, like so for example, Elixir and the Beam are very good at sort of concurrency and dealing with lots and lots of I/O. But maybe if I had to do some crazy number crunching or some really specific database queries or stuff, yeah, I could just offload that to a NIF or to some other process, or put it in a message queue and shove it off to some other server somewhere to process it and bring it back. Yeah, that's the kind of stuff where, yeah, if you really need to optimize it, you can break that part out.
Right. And I mean, on the same note, you know, I keep talking about, I've talked for months now about how Laravel's ecosystem is really cool, and I look from the outside. In fact, like, what's this thing called? Is it Telescope? It's called Telescope. I'll send you the link really quick. Laravel Telescope. I didn't know this existed, and it was really cool because Jaggy was showing it to me. It's a debugger assistant. And so this Laravel Telescope thing, it sits there, and it hooks into your Laravel app, and it keeps track of any requests coming in. So it's sort of like a log viewer. So you can look at requests, where it was going to, how long it took. You can look at any commands that were run, e.g. like someone running PHP Artisan, do something, migrate, do some command, or like some server-side command. You can look at any scheduled jobs, any running jobs. So basically like the Oban web style viewer or Sidekick style, like job viewing is in there. It keeps track of any exceptions, any dumps you might run. It even keeps track of like SQL queries, so you can see if there are any slow queries that are running. It keeps track of like how many instances of models are in memory. It keeps track of like sent mail. It did so much stuff. It's really cool. But I just wanted to like say how cool I thought that was. But in the same spirit, I've been really impressed with the Elixir ecosystem, first party, second party packages coming out. So I don't remember if we talked about it or not, but there was a blog post a while back, a few weeks ago, where Jose was talking about how he was sort of building a simple, secure auth generator that'll roll with Phoenix. So you can do Phoenix, mix Phoenix Gen auth, and you'll get like a pretty simple, secure thing out of the box. And we could probably talk for a while about that, because there's a lot of nuance around it. Also, Today, I saw Jose tweet about Phoenix LiveView dashboard, which is, I guess, similar to this telescope thing where it's a LiveView dashboard that shows you like resources, resource usage and metrics and stuff about your Phoenix application. It looks great. And then, you know, Phoenix 1.5 RC coming out with Phoenix LiveView generators and a few other enhancements. So it just seems like they're just pumping out the hits recently in the Elixir Phoenix ecosystem.
Looking at the Laravel stuff, it looks like they're playing catch up.
Yeah, there's so many Laravel things, you know. Again, there's caveats around that. Like, I don't want to get into that now. But yeah, like there's some really cool stuff. And on Twitter, I saw Jose mention that there might even be one more thing they want to announce. It just depends on how productive the team is. But yeah, there's the Elixir community, like the Phoenix, especially when it comes to web services, man, it's hard. It's becoming harder to beat it for sure.
Yeah. Well, I haven't had a chance to look at any of this new Phoenix and stuff because it literally all just came out all at once today. Plus there's new PubSub, which as I mentioned, I lean on pretty heavily. So I got to make sure there's nothing there that I need to know about.
I mean, I feel like one of my interviews, I got to interview with an executive and I was asking this person, he had asked me a bunch of questions and he's like, do you have any questions for me? So I asked him a bunch of questions. And one of the questions was, you know, from your position looking at me, like what advice would you give to me if I were you? And he thought for a while and he was like, just keep building stuff. You know, don't work yourself to death. Just like, to keep building stuff, you know, on the side, like make it a hobby. Again, don't kill yourself, but just keep building stuff. And so I'm truly trying to take that to heart. Like I said, write and go every day, but I feel like it would be difficult for me to drop Elixir and Phoenix altogether, especially for side projects, because A, I know it really well. Or I feel like I know it pretty well now. B, the ecosystem is just good. The language is good. So, you know, while Go might be my day job, I feel like Elixir might still be my sort of my happy place, I guess, if that makes any sense.
I like to add a corollary onto just building stuff should be, or maybe an axiom. I can never remember the right thing. Sort of add on to that. You should be building stuff, but also putting stuff out there.
Yeah.
It's nice to build things in a vacuum sometimes and just play with things and throw them away. But even just publishing this like half finished idea of something that you've done or created or thought about is worth it. Other people learn from that. And plus just a little self-publicity never hurt anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was telling me, you know, he had this idea. It was super simple. They put it out there and it ended up doing really well with the person that he was working with it on. So there's always opportunities for financial gain too, you know, having other assets, I guess, in that respect. And there's apps flying all over the place these days, you know, so I guess it's a little bit more difficult because you have to like really nail like a product market or like really understand who you're building it for. But like you said, you can still just put stuff out there and you learn a lot on that side too. So I think like a lot of developers, especially early on in their careers, they spend a lot of time thinking about code and zero time thinking about how to sell something.
Yeah. I mean, forget about even selling stuff. Like that's the end goal, but I wasn't even thinking about that in mind. Just, I think I mentioned Cult of Done on here before. One of the tenets of Cult of Done is, publishing an idea or like, you know, writing about an idea is a ghost of Done, they call it. I'll put a link to the Cult of Done in the show notes. It's really great.
But yeah, I don't feel like I'm going to be dropping Phoenix at all anytime soon. So we'll have lots more Elixir and Phoenix talk, I'm sure. Oh, I also wanted to mention that Vue.js 3 is in beta 1 today, as of today.
Woo woo! I cannot wait for this observable. What do they call it? They don't call it observable. The thing where you can wrap up your own objects in the Vue observer pattern and like make your own, basically make your own mini Vuex. I know you can do it with Vue 2.0 now, but like they're making it more of an official thing. I'm just going to grab that and just friggin' run with it because I've been waiting for that pattern to emerge so I can actually ditch a lot of the stuff in Vuex that's tying me down.
I think it is called observable.
Okay. Oh, there it is. Yep.
Yeah, yeah, pretty sure. Yeah, Vue.observable. Yep. Yeah, there's some interesting stuff. I'll have to try and track it down, but I saw a slide deck of Evan sort of state of the union as of Vue 3 beta. And so, you know, he was talking about what does beta mean? It means that all the RFCs they were planning on accepting for Vue 3 have been implemented. So now they're going on stability and performance and compatibility and ecosystem stuff, right? So Vue 3 dev tools, Vuex for Vue 3, Vue 3 router, you know, sort of the first party ecosystem being updated and tested for that stuff. He talked about some other things too. So it looks like in Vitor, I guess Vue 3 has better TypeScript. I mean, Vue 3 is written in TypeScript anyway, but Vue 3 on the other side has better TypeScript support. And so it looked like some people in the ecosystem were playing with sort of pseudo-typed helpers or linters, I guess. So the screenshot was of VS Code in Vitor. And in the template, like VIF, in the template expression for VIF, it was A is less than B, and it had a linter warning saying can't compare a string to a number, for example.
Nice, nice.
Yeah, so it seems like there's a lot of interesting ideas happening there. I'm trying to remember. I'll put the link to it in the show notes. But yeah, Vue 3 beta is coming out. The composition API seems real interesting. Again, it's sort of not, it kind of Go-ish, I suppose. Like, take these functions, make them real small and share them, right? So each function is like very specific and generic in scope, and then you pull them in where you need them to be adaptable to whatever, wherever you want to use them. But essentially you're composing your program as opposed to inheriting a program, I guess.
Yeah, and mixins are kind of a superset of that, right? It's kind of, it's composition, but it's a lot bigger and more heavy-handed, because you're kind of composing entire concepts as opposed to maybe individual functions. I went really, really heavy on implementing Vue mixins when I was building out the logger for the console, because I wanted to have I needed this base functionality for his logger components, the actual UI forms that you type in. I need a lot of common functionality there, but then obviously I need to customize it for each individual implementation. Mixins were a great fix for that. But man, I didn't run into any technical limitations, but the implicitness of it made it really, really hard to grok. Like, where's this function defined? What's calling this? Where's the cause? Where's the effect? Because things were spread across different files and different names. And I think what I ended up doing was I had to like make a template.vue file. It was just not imported or used anywhere, but it was just in the folder alongside all the real ones, so that I could just copy and paste it and then fill in the functions that needed to be implemented for that mixin, because it got to be too hard to keep track of what needed to be put where. So I had to just literally make this copy-paste thing that I could use to get off the ground running for the next time. Because when I go and look at it a couple weeks from now, yeah, I'm not even going to know what I'm looking at unless I have that. So like stuff like that, I got to be honest, I'm a little worried. I want to upgrade. I'm a little worried about breaking changes. I don't know really how bad it's going to be, especially with Nuxt. Who knows what the heck's going on under the scenes there. I'll probably wait until an official Nuxt release comes out that supports Vue, and then I'll upgrade at that point.
It looks like that's actually, they have a prototype running Vue 3 already.
Okay, good to know.
According to the slides, which I just put in the show notes. But yeah, Nuxt, yeah, it seems like there's already like a prototype of the Vue 3 dev tools, already a prototype of Nuxt running on Vue 3. It seems like they're doing, you know, they're knocking stuff out pretty well. The you know, I just put a link to the dot or the presentation in the show notes. There's a lot more stuff in here. Like more specifically, it talks about some pretty more in-depth things like optimized slot generation, static tree hoisting, static prop hoisting, inline handler, lots of hoisting going on here. but it talks about, let me find some of the performance metrics, because, it talks about double the speed and half the memory usage, up to 100% faster component instance initialization. That's pretty wild.
See, that's a big enough reason for me just to do the upgrade. I'm not in a rush to do it. I have no reason. I don't need these new features. You know, I'm not doing a ton of heavy UI development now. If I start a new project, obviously I would use it, but I'm not gonna jump both feet in on this until it's probably, you know, 1.0 or 3.0 release. This is cool though. This is really, really cool. And like RHR, the console is a big app. It takes a while to load. And actually, I think it probably loads faster on my phone than on my PC even, like, because phones are so fast. This will be a big help. Just the raw performance wise should be nice.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff. Oh yeah. IE11 is still supported with U3 somehow.
Don't care.
That's cool. Yeah. Don't care, but that's still wild. There's a lot of neat things. Like it seems like they really decoupled the core. So everything is like small packages, which is nice. Like I said, they moved from Flow to TypeScript. All of that's like under the hopes of making Vue itself more maintainable. And it said the new core runtime is 10 KB gzip now, which is smaller.
That's awesome.
Than it was before. It's 100% tree shaking friendly, apparently. It just seems like a really good quality release.
So is the whole core written in TypeScript?
As far as I'm aware, yeah.
Yeah, so that's awesome. So I mean, the TypeScript support for components is going to be 100% then, right?
It's good. Yeah, it's much, much, much better. Yeah. It's much better.
That's another one of those things where it's like, I can't afford I can't steer the ship in that direction now. Mm-hmm. But if I was starting a new project, 100%, I would just dive right in on that TypeScript.
Yeah, yeah. It's we're using it on this new app, on DK's side, new app. And it's been pretty nice. Like, I'm able to go in. I mean, even just like the editor stuff, if I may not like know exactly what's going on, I can jump in and like command B around. The tooling is just really good. It's really nice. So it's been helpful to say the least so far. But I guess, yeah, that's all I have for news. Like the news, the weekly update on Vue and Phoenix.
Yeah, lots of stuff going on. Lots of stuff going on over in that ecosystem right now.
Yeah, yeah. It feels like there's lots going on with many ecosystem, I guess. Or, you know, like there's a lot of stuff going on with Go, a lot of stuff going on with Elixir. I'm constantly seeing people talk like pumping out Laravel stuff, which is cool. I guess those are really the only communities I'm looking at currently. Oh, I did want to give a shout out to a couple of friends of the show. Well, first of all, like Drew, I want to say congrats because he just got a job, which is awesome. His first dev job where he actually had to like go through interview processes with code tests and everything like that. So that's awesome. Congrats to him.
Awesome. Congrats, Drew.
Yeah. And also with that, he's been streaming a lot too. So he's been working on a junior dev job board called Protege, and he's been streaming working on that. So I'll put a link to his stream in the show notes. And another friend of the show, Nick, he's been streaming a lot too. So he's been streaming. He's building an interesting thing with Phoenix and Elixir. And so he's been streaming that on the evenings as well. So I'll put a link to his Twitch. I think his Twitch name is Kid Queb, and I think Drew's is Ducky87, but I'll put actual link to their Twitch streams in the show notes.
That's cool, man. That's awesome.
Yeah, I'll sign on. He'll be like, all right, I got a bunch of Elixir questions. Let's go. When I like jump into his chat, he'll like start asking me all of his Elixir questions.
He asks you?
Yeah.
Usually when you're watching someone on Twitch, it's the other way around, but all
right. Right, right, right. It's funny. He knows. He just second guesses himself a lot, I think. But yeah, I'll jump in and he'll be like, all right, here we go. I've got him lined up. Let's knock him down. So I was, you know, I was teaching him about like, oh, well, you can use pry here and like you can do this over there. And this is like a neat little trick for this. And yeah, it's been pretty fun. I just pulled up Nick's stream and he's programming right now.
What's he working on?
He's writing some React, it looks like.
Close the tab, Sean. Walk away.
He's talking to me right now. I wish you guys could hear this. He's talking about TypeScript.
Wait, can we patch him in?
Yeah, stand by. Here comes. That'd be awesome.
You can set it up with Audio Hijack. Add it as a feed.
Oh, this is weird. He's just talking at me now. You're both talking at me. All right. I feel like I just derailed everything, but...
Yeah, too much is going on.
This is awesome. All right, so we've got to bring it back down. Bring it back down. Bring this plane down. So yeah, is there anything meta show related, Rockwell, that you want to shout out?
Shout out Hole, our Lord and Savior Hole. Sean, if you have a couple minutes, I'd like to talk to you about Hole and what Hole has to offer you in your life. Have you considered all the options that Hole has to improve your lifestyle?
I don't understand. Okay, so Minecraft talk now. There, someone in our server is digging this gigantic hole in the ground.
To be specific, it's 128 by 128 down to bedrock.
It is enormous, and I don't understand why. And so I asked why, and I got uh, I got flogged in a public square for even asking why there's this giant square hole in the ground.
You just don't understand the beauty of hole.
What I don't understand is that how she got so far with just a stone pickaxe.
Oh, hold on.
Yes? Yes?
I wonder if we could get the founder of the whole religion on the show.
Oh, man. I get it. Get it? The whole religion? Yeah, I don't know. I don't. Yeah. We went in there and threw a beacon down for her and gave her that diamond pickaxe, efficiency 5. I feel like that spread things up quite a bit.
She was very happy about that.
I can bet.
And she still only put a small dent in the hole.
Yeah. Well, if anybody out there wants to talk about Go, I actually have had a couple of people DM me on Twitter and talk about Go and talk about actually jobs they're applying for and things like that. So that's been pretty cool. I always love to hear from people what they've got going on, what they're working towards, what they're going through in that regard. So I would love to hear any more feedback on Go, any tips, tricks, stories, libraries, whatever. Just send them my way.
You can send them at Sean on Twitter, Sean Washbot. You can tweet me, Shrockwell. It's S-C-H, Rockwell. And the show is DNC Cast. All one word. All lowercase. I don't think capitalization matters. It's all lowercase.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe, I don't know.
I can't imagine there's a variation there.
Yeah, that'd be wild. The impersonators would be going crazy, even crazier than they are. And as always, everything we talked about, it's going to be in the show notes at dnc.show. So I mentioned a few things like Mattermost and Gogs and GetTea, Goose. So links to those Go projects will be in the show notes. That's the one thing I've been trying to do to learn a little bit more is just look at open source and just see what they're doing. So if you're interested in doing that too, those links will be there.
Fun thing about URLs, domain names, not case sensitive. Everything after that slash, case sensitive. As far as resources and, you know, URLs go.
Right. I see a lot of people in advertising doing sort of camel casing words or Pascal casing words to make it easier for people to kind of see what the domain is quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought that was kind of nice.
We'll also post the show notes over on spectrum.chat, all lowercase, where you can see the show notes and discuss with us. Get a notification. It'll pop up. Say hi.
And as always, thanks to Spec for having us and putting us out there. And if you're looking for other design and development related podcasts, head on over to spec.fm and see what's going on over there.
All right, man. Back over to Eagle CAD hardware board design.
I smell some pasta that I'm going to go eat.
Mmm.
Smells really good. Well, I guess I will talk to you in 5 minutes, probably.
As always. See you later.
All right, see ya.